Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week was the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. We'll re-explore the case to bring his killers to justice.
But first, the legacy of Stephen Hawking and what he's meant for our understanding of the universe.
We are joined by two experts. Priya Natarajan is a professor in the departments of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Her publications include Rapid Growth of Seed Black Holes in the Early Universe by Supra-Exponential Accretion and New Observational Constraints on the Growth of the First Supermassive Black Holes. Peter Gallison also joins us. He's a professor in the Department of Physics and director of the Collection of the Historical Scientific Instruments at Harvard University. He's the author of How Experiments End, Einstein's Clocks, Poincare's Maps, and Image and Logic. He's also the co-editor of Einstein for the 21st Century, His Legacy in Science, Art, and Modern Culture, and the co-director of the documentaries Ultimate Weapon, The H-Bomb Dilemma, and Containment.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us to talk about and put the work of Stephen Hawking and his legacy into the context of physics and what he has meant for us. Peter Gallison, I thought we should start with you, given the work you've done on the history. So if you were going to put his work, his contribution, our understandings about the universe into a historic context, how would you help us understand that role?
When Einstein first developed his general theory of relativity in the midst of World War I in 1915, and then it was confirmed by the measurement of the bending of starlight just after the end of the war in November of 1919, Einstein became the most famous scientist in the world by far, really the most famous scientist since the time of Darwin or Newton. And that theory became a model for what science was. It was Einstein who had, in some sense, displaced Newton and changed our view that space could actually be bent in important ways. Almost immediately after Einstein published his paper, a friend of his named Karl Schwarzkopf discovered while he was at the front fighting in World War I that there was a solution to Einstein's equation that predicted what eventually became known as black holes. So it was many years before that was taken seriously as a physical thing. What Hawking did was to help us understand how black holes fit into the wider structure of physics, how it connected the great development of relativity with the astonishing revelations of quantum physics that was developed in the 1920s. So Hawking was a figure of unification in some ways, but also someone who opened up problems that are still today being much debated.
Now, Priya, you have said to me before we started recording that Hawking's contribution was really more on the theoretical basis rather than the actual measurable basis of black holes. Can you explain to us, lay people, non-physicists, what exactly you mean by all that?
So just as Peter mentioned, the black hole solution is an exact solution to Einstein's field equations, and it describes the shape of space around a compact mass, black hole. And in the real universe, we do see black holes, astrophysical black holes, that correspond to the end states of stars. So these are real objects in the universe that have the properties of a black hole solution, but we actually know that they exist because we can indirectly map their existence. And so I think where Hawking's work fits in is that he was trying really hard to understand the fundamental nature of black holes and the nature of the sort of sacred boundary that black holes have called the event horizon. And this is a boundary around a black hole which encases a singularity. So basically it's a place where all known physical laws break down. But this region is basically a point of no return. And so any phenomena that reveal the existence of the black hole have to occur outside the event horizon. So in astrophysics, we are constantly looking for regions of space-time that have the intense gravity of a black hole. However, whose presence we infer from the impact of either the bending of light around the strong gravity by black hole, or by the impact on motions of particles that are in the vicinity. For example, we know that quasars, which are the brightest beacons in the universe, these objects that outshine the galaxies that host them, are actually powered by supermassive black holes that have masses in excess of a billion times the mass of the sun, while they're feeding gas. And so gas, as it is sort of lurching towards this event horizon of the supermassive black hole, gets heated and starts to glow in the X-rays. And so that's how we've sort of inferred the presence of these monster black holes in the universe. However, we still don't understand what's really going on at the event horizon. And Hawking's work was really trying to understand, you know, I just told you that it's a point of no return and what that really means. You know, do you actually lose all the information about whatever went in and crossed the event horizon? So there are many puzzling fundamental problems that have to do with conservation of information. So do you lose all information about what went into a black hole? Can you ever retrieve it? Can you recover it? So these are very fundamental questions that we as astrophysicists can skirt, because we are looking at the impact of a black hole, how the presence of a black hole shapes the properties of the galaxy it's sitting in the center of, and so on. But, you know, he had a very, very nice sort of analogy to what is a fundamental problem. Oh, it's called the information paradox, which is what happens to information if it crosses the event horizon. And the analogy that I really like, it's like, you know, you have an Encyclopedia Britannica and you look up the capital of India and you know it's New Delhi, and then you burn the Encyclopedia Britannica, keep all the ashes in a box, so nothing has left this box. So the information that New Delhi is the capital of India is still in this box. It's in the ashes. We don't know how to recover it, and we don't know how it's saved. So, you know, Hawking used this analogy, beautiful analogy, to describe what's really likely going on inside the event horizon of a black hole. And as I said, you know, astrophysicists and astronomers, we have the liberty of just sort of looking outside and looking at the impact of black holes rather than really trying to understand the mathematical nature of black holes.
So let's back up just a little bit. And Peter Galison, maybe we bring you back in here. There is a significance of black holes that's related to really the origin of the universe. What is this origin? What is the significance of black holes?
Well, black holes are the most extreme objects that we know of. They are the most densely packed amount of mass that you can have. They seem to raise questions about the tiniest forms of matter and the singularity that Priya mentioned, that the center of a black hole looks like where space and time might be so extremely bent that you actually might create something more fundamental than space and time, where string theory becomes important, or where there's a kind of foaming aspect of space and time that we only see when it's spread out enough to look smooth to us. So it raises questions at the tiniest, most extreme parts of nature. At the same time, these supermassive black holes that Priya mentioned, like the one that's 4.5 million times the mass of the sun in the center of the Milky Way, or other ones that are billions of times the mass of the sun, actually shape things the size of galaxies and even bigger. So they seem to be objects that are just that range in their effects in the world from the most microscopic scales of physics to the large scale structure of things as big or bigger than galaxies. And that's really astonishing. Hawking has helped to advance our understanding of trying to put these different scales and effects together.
You mentioned string theory, and for those of us who are not physicists, how can we understand that?
Well, we've thought for a long time that the most fundamental objects in the world were tiny particles that also might act in some experiments or observations as waves, but they could be thought of as hugely smaller than a BB, but like particles. And an idea that's arisen in the last couple of decades that's still a fundamental interest to theorists is that maybe the most fundamental things are not like little BBs, but more like little strings. And the vibrations of those strings, like the vibrations of the strings plucked on a violin, could be correspond to different energies. And those different energies, by Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared, might be the more energy might actually act like the particles that we see of different masses. So the idea of string theory was that maybe the basic things were little strings and their vibrations differentiated this little string into the different mass particles that we observed. So it was a way of unifying the world and unifying all the different kinds of particles and different kinds of forces, that everything was simply different excitations, different vibrations of this basic string.
So Priya, you've been really building on Stephen Hawking's work on black holes. You worked on the formation of black holes. What have you found in terms of black hole formation?
What was very clear is that one way to make the first sort of seed black holes is provided by nature as the end states of stars. So when the first stars formed in the universe, and if they happen to be above 10 times the mass of our sun, then they would burn up all their hydrogen and helium, exhaust their nuclear reactors, and explode and leave behind a little black hole. Of course, it's quite uncertain what the masses of those initial stars were, but we have every reason to believe that in the very early universe, in the pristine universe, the first generation of stars to form were likely more massive than the generations that we see around us assembling right now. So it's quite likely that you formed massive stars, and most of them likely ended their lives leaving little black holes. But the puzzle then is, how do you start from a little remnant, which is maybe a few times the mass of the sun, and how do you grow it to a billion times the mass of the sun, that too extremely rapidly in the early universe? And the reason for that is that the time when the first stars switch on in the universe and the time that we are starting, we're inching and looking further and further back and discovering these quasars, these bright beacons that are powered by supermassive black holes already in place. So we are starting to come up with a timing crunch of, you know, how could you really grow these little seeds to make the monsters that we see? And so that's where a lot of the work of my research group and my work has been focused on, trying to come up with other viable ways to make the first black holes, and in particular, ways to make them much more massive from the get-go, so that you don't have as much of a timing problem to grow them into sort of the billion solar mass behemoths that are powering the quasars that we are seeing for sure. So, you know, we came up with an idea about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, called direct collapse black holes that form in very rare sites in the universe, which are from pristine gas. And so we sort of developed a whole kind of machinery of understanding where spatially in the early universe you could form them, and therefore what are the potential observational signatures that show that you could have this additional new channel for making black holes. And, you know, a decade later, when we're finally able to do the kinds of simulations on a computer that can replicate the physics, we find that these are viable and are potentially even detectable by the upcoming James Webb Space Telescope. So it's really exciting that the legacy of people like Hawking and, you know, Penrose and Dennis Sharma, Martin Rees, Donald Lindenbell. So all these people in physics and astrophysics have been working on, you know, understanding black hole growth and fueling how they grow. And so it's been really exciting to build upon that and to come up with an entirely new channel to make sort of the first generation of black holes.
So it sounded from what I read in your work that you also suggest that they eventually stop growing. What happens then?
That was a question that always intrigued me when I started working on black holes during my PhD. So when black holes become extremely massive, they can actually stunt their own growth. And the way this works is, as matter falls into a black hole, it gets sped up. So if you can imagine a gas packet that's falling in, it gets sped up, it gets heated, and it starts emitting in the X-rays. And now the glow from X-rays, if the feeding rate is high enough, could be so strong that it could disrupt further inflow. And so the black hole could simply stunt itself. And, you know, if you actually do the basic physics calculation, you realize that you can obtain an upper mass limit for black holes at any epoch.
If we're going to think about some of the things that Hawking leaned toward, it sounded like he liked the idea of a multiverse.
You know, one idea in physics that's become popular among some people and anathema to others is that we wanted to explain why the certain constants of nature, so the charges on particles are the way they are, seem to need to be tuned almost to an incredible precision for there to be a universe that would be habitable, that would have the structures that we observe in it. And that seems so miraculous that people said, well, what, there must be a reason for this. One idea was that, in fact, there are many copies of the universe with, you know, where the charge on the electron is not the opposite of the charge on the proton, but, you know, 2/3 or 5/7. And if that was true, we wouldn't be here. So all of these copies exist. And the fact that one of them happens to have supported life isn't a miracle. It's just like, you know, the tadpole that swimming around in a little mud puddle and says, isn't it great that, you know, it turned out that there was this mud puddle just right for me and my tadpole friends to be in. And, you know, somebody looking down says, no, you know, look, if you'd been born in a drying up puddle or a frozen puddle, you wouldn't be able to survive. So you just happen to be in one of the many possible places where water and sand come together. And that's why you're here. So the multiverse says there are many, many copies of the universe. And we, you know, the fact that one of them happens to be good physically and chemically for our lives is just the law of averages in some way. So that's one idea. It answers a certain question. It's other physicists don't like that. But I think that Hawking's great contribution was really something that Priya mentioned earlier, which is all of physics tells you that if you know the present, you can predict the future or calculate back to the way the past was. And black holes seem to disrupt that idea, because if things fell in, you couldn't tell what the world was like. You can't tell from a black hole whether it was made out of pianos or tadpoles or stars or what. So it seems knowing the present doesn't seem to help you figure out what the past was like. And so there's a big debate about this. And Hawking pointed out that this leads to a real contradiction. If the black hole can't really tell how it was made, and eventually he predicted that black holes would evaporate, nothing would be left but heat radiation, then, you know, any information that went into it was gone forever. And that really has bothered physicists. So that problem that he set out in 1974-75 still troubles physicists to today. And Hawking was working on it right up to the time of his death in collaboration with Malcolm Perry, Cambridge, and Andy Strominger, my colleague here at Harvard. And they really have, you know, tried to advance on that problem, try to figure out how there could have been left the information just outside the horizon and avoiding this terrible contradiction that seemed easy.
Priya, what would you add to that?
Like Peter, I have to say that I find the idea of multiverses, going back to multiverses, I find it appealing. So I want to point out that I believe in the multiverse, and the operative word is believe. So it's not clear that it's a testable hypothesis yet. However, you know, I think in 1543, when Copernicus reordered the cosmos, the known cosmos at the time, he could not have predicted that, you know, 450, 500 years later, human beings would set out two satellites, Voyager 1 and 2, that could actually leave the solar system, right? So the path of future science is hard to predict. And I'm kind of hopeful and excited at these sort of concepts that seem mind-bending at the moment. And, you know, coming back to Peter's point about Hawking's contribution to understanding the nature of the event horizon and the interior of a black hole, and, you know, how black holes could evaporate, that, you know, he expected that at the edge of the event horizon, you could probably make particles and antiparticles, and those should eventually kind of become radiation that we should be able to detect at some point in the future. So the only problem is that this process of Hawking radiation and evaporation has time scales that are so long for these supermassive black holes that we know that exist. You know, it's much longer than the age of the universe, so the process is not as important. However, for primordial black holes, if there were any tiny, tiny black holes that formed very, very early on in the universe, then they should go zap, and we should be able to detect that radiation. Of course, we haven't found anything yet, And I think, you know, black holes are just enigmatic. Once again, as Peter mentioned, they're tantalizing because they are sort of the limits of our knowledge. They push us. And the whole framework of having order and predictability kind of breaks down. And so I think for me personally, that's what I find really tantalizing about working on black holes and thinking about it. It sort of represents a limit that we would, is a challenge, poses a challenge to physicists and astronomers to push at.
You know, there was something, Peter, that you also wrote in one of your more popular pieces, and it was a quote, I think, from Hawking, where you said the universe appeared spontaneously, starting off in every possible way. What did he mean by that?
Well, this comes back to the question you were asking before about the multiverse and that Peter was addressing. If you imagine a landscape with many valleys and hills, and then at each of the valleys, you could imagine, if you were smooth enough, you could imagine a ball rolling up and down the sides. Well, those, each of the characteristics, a deep-walled, narrow canyon, a very shallow canyon, the balls would go back and forth at different rates. And you could imagine that as producing something like different particles, because the energy would be different in these different valleys. And each of these valleys corresponds in a somewhat metaphorical, but not entirely metaphorical way, with a different universe. So the idea was that the universe could be all these copies of the universe with such radically different properties that maybe one of them would correspond to our universe, the one that we have access to. Whether we could ever figure out a way to tell if there was another universe adjacent to ours in some sense is, as Priya mentioned, you know, at this point, just speculation, but that's the idea.
Priya, so let's bring you back in on this. What have you been able to observe and how?
One of the intriguing things, as I mentioned earlier, is you get a lot of physical effects, radiation from the vicinity of a black hole. So gas that's falling in, so lighting up as sources that you would see with instruments that have the capability to detect X-ray radiation. So Chandra Space Telescope, for example, is detecting all these growing black holes strewn everywhere in the universe. So there's populations of them. And so what we have been thinking about and working on is a framework where you start out with these small sort of seed black holes, and then you grow and evolve them in tandem with the growth and assembly of galaxies in the universe over cosmic time, and to see if we can reproduce the kinds of observations that we actually see of assembling galaxies, their central black holes, and the kinds of impact these black holes appear to have on modulating the formation of stars in a galaxy. We believe now that the radiation that comes from the outer regions, well outside, we're talking about, you know, a million times the Schwarzschild radius or the event horizon. So activity around there, sort of the, you know, energy that is produced appears to heat gas and stars. And so there are these sort of impacts, these signatures, invisible kind of invisible activity of the black hole that leaves very visible signatures, detectable signatures have been found. And so the kind of work that we've been doing is sort of build this storyline over entire cosmic history for the assembly of black holes. So for example, there are many, many interesting aspects that we've recently looked into. One of them is, you know, what is the kind of immediate environment that a black hole seed would grow very prolifically? Are there environments where the growth is super boosted, or is there a limit to how much you can feed a black hole? And so we found that, you know, the environments in which black holes form initially determines their fate. So you can form a direct collapse black hole that tends to form in a very gas-rich environment. So it would grow very, very rapidly. And so it's the most likely ancestor for the super duper massive and ultra massive black holes that we're detecting in nearby bright galaxies.
I thank you very much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank
you. It's a pleasure.
Priya Natarajan is a professor in the departments of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Her publications include Rapid Growth of Seed Black Holes in the Early Universe by Supra-Exponential Accretion and New Observational Constraints on the Growth of the First Supermassive Black Holes. Peter Galison is a professor in the Department of Physics and director of the Collection of the Historical Scientific Instruments at Harvard University. He's the author of How Experiments End, Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps, and Image and Logic. He's also the co-editor of Einstein for the 21st Century, His Legacy in Science, Art, and Modern Culture, and the co-director of the documentaries Ultimate Weapon, The H-Bomb Dilemma, and Containment.
When we come back,
last week was the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. We'll re-explore the case to bring his killers to justice.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In 1980, the Archbishop Oscar Romero was gunned down while giving Mass in a Salvadorian chapel. For three decades, his killers ran free, but a small nonprofit organization called the Center for Justice and Accountability filed a civil lawsuit against one of the alleged killers and won a multimillion-dollar judgment against him. Matt Eisenbrandt, one of the lawyers on the case, has written a book about the assassination and the case. Matt joins us now. Matt Eisenbrandt is the legal director of the Canadian Center for International Justice and the author of Assassination of a Saint, The Plot to Murder Oscar Romero and the Quest to Bring His Killers to Justice. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Matt Eisenbrandt. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about this really fantastic book, Assassination of a Saint. I thought what we should do is start with the context of what was going on in Latin America and particularly in El Salvador during this time before the assassination and leading up to it. How would you describe it?
It's a convergence of the Cold War with a lot of changes in the Catholic Church, I would say. In particular, there was a real worry by the United States government and by right-wing governments throughout Latin America, particularly military dictatorships, about insurgencies in their countries and a worry in the Cold War context that those countries might fall to left-wing governments. And at the same time, the Catholic Church had undergone quite a revolution of its own, and particularly in Latin America, having a focus now on the poor, the majority of people in those countries. In particular, that played out with a much greater focus on not on charity, but instead on looking at the factors in society that had led to such inequality, and therefore an attempt to empower people and communities to change the situations in their countries. And in particular in El Salvador, that led to immense resistance from those who wanted to maintain the status quo and led to violent suppression of the church and people associated with the church.
I had read that the Civil War there claimed something like 75,000 civilians' lives. Is that about right?
That's about right. I mean, there's you know, some difference in the numbers, but that is the one that most people use.
Now, you noted in the book about the coffee sector and the role that it played there, the inequalities it produced, particularly with the campesinos. How did that system work and how did it contribute to this?
Without going into the entire history of it, essentially at the end of the 19th century, there was a great change in landholding in El Salvador and other parts of Central America, where there was an outlawing of communal lands, particularly indigenous land, and a privatization of large estates. And this was in part through liberal economic policies that also, you know, sort of came around the same time as coffee was booming and coffee required these sorts of estates. And it led to a concentration of land in the hands of very few, while campesino communities were dispossessed of land and forced to work on the larger estates. So this led, you know, throughout the 20th century then to a consolidation of economic power in the hands of a small collection of families in El Salvador to the detriment of the larger population.
And then there was a rising of social movements starting around, 1977, 78. What was that like?
And I would say it dates back before that, but really came to a head in the late 1970s in that time period. After great widespread repression and mass killings in 1932, there were a few decades that passed of military rule where there was not a real consolidation of outward calls for reform. And in the 60s and into the 70s, there was finally a renewed movement in essentially every sector of society. Teachers' unions were formed, campesino groups, you know, any area of society you can think of, there were open calls for reforms. And by the late 70s, those groups, the popular organizations, as they were known, were able to, you know, shut down different sectors of cities on any given day through marches and protests and takeovers of buildings. But these were still done in a way where these groups were not calling for a violent overthrow of the government, but instead were calling for reforms, government reforms that would improve the situation in the country.
Did the U.S. play a very major role during this period of time?
Well, yes and no. Certainly, the U.S. role was not as large as it was in the 1980s once the Civil War had started and the Reagan administration was sending hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid. But the United States government, even in the 70s, was still always the elephant in the room. Starting in the 60s with the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, the U.S. was training the Salvadoran military and other Latin American militaries in counterinsurgency and how to essentially fend off the possibility of a Marxist insurgency. And that military training actually helped lead to the formation of the death squads that we saw in the 60s, but much more prominently in the 70s and 80s. So although I would say that in the late 70s, the U.S. role perhaps was not quite as strong as it would be in later years, you know, the U.S. government was always a looming presence.
So now let's talk about the Archbishop himself. Now, he was chosen, as you noted in your book, because he was not thought to be somebody that would really create problems in El Salvador for the ruling elite. But things started to change. How would you describe that whole period?
When Romero was chosen as Archbishop, the Catholic Church was so important in El Salvador that the Vatican actually consulted with the military government and with members of the oligarchy of the wealthy families to get their input on who should be the new Archbishop. And their choice overwhelmingly was Romero, whereas many of the priests working in communities who were practitioners of liberation theology were not in favor of Romero because, as you say, he was seen as someone who probably would not, you know, rock the boat. What I would say is that Romero went through an evolution whereby he became much more outspoken. It's not that he was entirely against the changes that were going on in the Catholic Church before he was Archbishop. He certainly had views about Marxism that he had expressed before on certain topics like that, but it's not that he was entirely recalcitrant. In 1977, just 3 weeks after he became Archbishop, his friend and fellow priest, Rutilio Grande, was murdered by a death squad linked to the military. And in Rutilio Grande's death, there's some public mythology that Romero had a conversion. And I'm not sure that is really true, but I do think that it sped up his evolution and made him far more outspoken against abuses. And Grande's death did cause him to say, I will not participate in government events, you know, until his murder is solved, which of course it never was, and no one was held accountable for it. So from that day forward, Archbishop Romero stopped cooperating with any government functions, did not participate. And so I think that's the transformation that he went through, to becoming much more outspoken and sort of understanding that it was necessary for him to play that role to protect not only his priests, but also to protect the vast majority of Salvadorans who were being oppressed.
At the very beginning of the book, there was a passage about how he was targeted for assassination. And you noted advertisements and the significance of typeface. And why was this important?
Well, in El Salvador at that time, paid advertisements in the newspaper were a form of political speech, an important form of political speech. And it's quite stunning to go back and read those, because there would be, you know, full page ads taken out by different groups. And sometimes they were the popular organizations. Sometimes they were groups representing landowners' interests. And they would be, you know, sort of large statements laying out political views, and in some cases, very directly denouncing and attacking individuals or groups. And so there were paid advertisements, Campos Pagados, that were targeting Romero and the church more generally for being communists, for being traitors, for even being terrorists. And so this was an important form of, I don't know if you even want to call it political speech, but just for shorthand, we'll say that. And it sent important signals to different sectors of society, you know, about how individuals and groups should be portrayed.
He was killed just after calling on members of the military to not obey the dictatorship, but God's law. And he had also taken on the Supreme Court. So he was taking a lot of risks. Did he have a sense that he might pay for this with his life?
The risks that he took are indescribable. Romero knew that he was likely to be killed. There's no doubt about that. He received hundreds of death threats, very detailed letters. He was denounced regularly on TV and elsewhere, and he did not shy away from what he felt were his religious and theological obligations. He did not talk in general terms. He talked in very specific terms. He denounced the Supreme Court when he felt like they were not upholding the interests of justice. He denounced military leaders. He called, for example, on the Minister of Defense in 1980 to resign. He called out one of the key death squad figures, Roberto Davison, who was eventually involved in his murder. He called out the oligarchs very specifically and said that, you know, they were the cause of the problem. So I think the general knowledge about Romero's murder was that it was carried out because of his criticism of the military. And certainly that is true, but he did not limit his denunciations and critiques to the military, but also delivered them against what he saw as the other recalcitrant sectors of society, including the wealthy landowners and business people.
So let's now turn to the Center for Justice and Accountability, which is the organization that filed the lawsuit that your book is based around. You were, what, 26 when you joined the organization? How did you come there?
I had been out of law school less than a year and was working doing immigration and refugee work in Los Angeles. And an opportunity for a staff attorney position opened up at CJA. And at the time, they were looking for somebody who was admitted to the bar and who spoke Spanish and had some background in immigration because of a particular case that they were working on at the time. You know, the stars aligned and I was able to get that job. And by that time, CJA was already looking into the Romero case sort of on a preliminary level, because the year before they had discovered one of Romero's killers living in California, Alvaro Saravia. And so by the time I joined CJA, that investigation was already open and then took off quite a bit in the following year, in part after the conclusion of another important El Salvador case, which was against two former ministers of defense, the one I just mentioned, General Garcia, who Romero called on to resign, and his successor, General Vitas Casanova. There was an important trial against them, a judgment against them for the torture of three Salvadorans who now lived in the United States. So it was the verdict in that case that really opened up the other El Salvador work for CJA, and that was the moment at which I was coming into the organization.
How did you find out about Saravia being in California?
Well, there were two important events in 2001 that happened. The first is that a Salvadoran man working with CJA actually went into a law office in San Francisco and saw Alvaro Saravia sitting in the law office and knew who he was. So that was an important and amazing revelation. And then later in 2001, the Miami Herald newspaper ran an article about torturers and war criminals living in the United States. And one of the people that the paper mentioned was Saravia, mentioned his involvement in Archbishop Romero's assassination, and then very critically indicated that he was living in Modesto, California, just a few hours away from CJA's headquarters in San Francisco. And so those two pieces of information were what led CJA to really start looking into the Romero case.
Did you have to go find a plaintiff, or was there already a plaintiff?
Well, there was interest in injustice in Archbishop Romero's case, and our client in the case is someone whose identity has been protected and filed the case in the name of J. Doe. It is a relative of Archbishop Romero, and that person sought the court's permission to proceed in the case anonymously, and so was able to do that throughout the case. But that being said, you know, that person obviously brought the case. I talk in the book about us being the legal team and our work on the case, and I don't talk much about the plaintiff, but that's intentional because of protecting that person's identity. But needless to say that the case, although we were acting on that person's behalf, the case was brought by that specific relative, J. Doe.
I was curious about how the plaintiff comes about coming to CJA, given the rest of the case and how it developed.
Right. I was just going to say that obviously we partnered with, you know, key figures in El Salvador who had had connections. And, you know, we obviously had discussions with those people who then had the right connections and knew the lay of the land. And obviously, you know, a relationship was able to evolve through those contacts.
In doing the investigation, and this was quite fascinating reading all the details of how this went on, you had somebody who was sort of an insider. You had a getaway car driver. How did these come about?
Through, you know, through hard investigation, through amazing support from people in El Salvador, and through quite a bit of luck, you know, as these things often go in investigations. You know, we put together a plan, I should say, during essentially the 1 year that the case was active. Our investigation was focused on finding evidence against Alvaro Saravia, who was the defendant in our case. But in fact, we already had quite a bit of that through documents and through some earlier testimony. But we were trying to investigate the support structures of the death squad that killed Romero. So in other words, our interest was trying to look up the chain of command, if you will, to those above Saravia who might have been financing death squad operations or involved in death squad operations or supporting that death squad from above. And so a big part of our investigation was attempting to find witnesses and evidence against those people. What ended up resulting was a few witnesses coming forward and providing information on that front, combined with some of the documents that we already had. In terms of the driver himself, he had testified in 1987 secretly that he had been the driver for the assassination, and then he disappeared. And we, you know, didn't necessarily think that we had to have him as a witness, but, you know, our judgment was, well, he's testified previously, So perhaps if we can find him, maybe he'll be willing to testify again. And as I describe in the book, my colleagues on one trip to El Salvador decided to go to his hometown, and through an amazing set of coincidences that I lay out in the book, managed to determine that the driver was actually in the U.S. Witness Protection Program. And so through a number of steps in trying to gain access to him in the Witness Protection Program, we eventually got a big surprise when he contacted us and eventually agreed to testify in the case. And that was, you know, quite critical to have that sort of insider giving testimony on the record.
So he was the witness that called your co-counsel?
That's right. We had been trying to track him down through contacts at the Witness Protection Program, but obviously that's an organization whose role is to keep things secret. And so one day, completely out of the blue, after we had almost given up on the idea that we might be successful, he called my colleague and said that he was witness 5145. And it was from there that our relationship with him developed, and he eventually agreed to testify.
What about the process of actually tracking down Savaria and the others that you were investigating? What were the impediments that you faced in that?
The single biggest impediment in anything related to the Romero case is security. Even today, 37 years later, El Salvador is an incredibly violent and dangerous place. And Romero's assassination remains a topic that is dangerous to speak about. So trying to access witnesses or trying to track down our descendant who was on the run, the biggest hurdle was trying to get information where it might be dangerous for people to share that with us. And obviously, you know, in the book, I talk about our investigation a bit from the perspective as U.S. lawyers working on this case, but we worked in conjunction with several, you know, amazing people in El Salvador, some of whom are named in the book, some of whom are not, to protect their own security. And so we worked very closely with them and obviously took their lead on how to proceed in a country as dangerous as El Salvador. So even some of the witnesses that did come forward and that I do talk about in the book, I still don't disclose their identity. And in fact, as I mentioned early on, there is more evidence and there are other witnesses that we spoke to that I can't even talk about. And so just by the simple fact of that, by me not even being in El Salvador and writing about an assassination that happened 37 years ago, it's still dangerous for people to talk about it or have their names associated with it. So I would say that that was the biggest difficulty that we had. Another one is certainly when you're coming from the United States, there's a natural distrust in El Salvador of people from the United States who might be looking into something like this. Not just a distrust about whether there are any links to the U.S. government and the role that the U.S. government has played in El Salvador, but also the sense that there are plenty of, you know, people who have come down from the United States over the years who want to, you know, help or do good things in El Salvador and then haven't followed through, or their work has had unintended bad consequences, things like that. And so there's a level of trust that has to be established with activists in El Salvador, with professionals in El Salvador, with witnesses when you're coming from the United States. And that was something that we had to work long and hard to achieve, not just in the Romero case, but in all of our El Salvador work.
Yeah, speaking of the United States, there were investigations both in El Salvador and in the United States, but they took different types of turns. How would you describe some of these?
They did. They all had different outcomes, and I do chronicle those somewhat in the book. So, for example, the first investigation started the day of Romero's assassination when a judge was, you know, assigned to look into the case. And 3 days later, the national police attempted to kill him, and he had to flee the country and stay out of the country for the next 10 years. In 1987, when the driver secretly testified, the U.S. government at that time, through a series of complicated political reasons, was very supportive of trying to investigate Romero's assassination in El Salvador. And that led to the driver's testimony which then caused Alvaro Sarabia to be arrested in Miami, where he was then living and had come with a U.S. visa. But in fact, his case, he was eventually let out of jail because the arrest warrant that was issued against him in El Salvador as a result of the driver's testimony made its way up to the Supreme Court of El Salvador, where that was dominated by right-wing figures who invalidated the arrest warrant. And that was really the best opportunity ever for a prosecution in El Salvador, and that was all thrown out the window. There were other investigations that took place. An official at the U.S. Embassy actually spoke with Sarabia in 1990 and got important information about the assassination, but the U.S. government never followed through with that. In 1993, the UN-sponsored Truth Commission also investigated Romero's case and actually spoke with Sarabia, who again provided important testimony. And that case resulted in a very detailed report from the Truth Commission naming names. And 5 days after the Truth Commission report came out, the Salvadoran legislature enacted a sweeping amnesty law that was in place for the next 23 years. So, you know, all of those different investigations had the potential to produce results, but, you know, in the end did not lead to any prosecutions in El Salvador.
Now, there were others that you also named in the book that sounded like they had really big roles in this. And one of them was a dentist who apparently used his tools to make particular kinds of bullets. And then there was another man, I think it was Roberto
Davison. Yeah, Davison.
So who were these people and what role do you think they played in this assassination?
Well, Roberto Davison is an absolutely central figure, not just in the Romero assassination, but in the history of El Salvador. He had a military intelligence background, had gotten some training in the United States, and built himself into this sort of dual figure where he had a clandestine side where he was actually running a death squad, you know, and his people were carrying out targeted assassinations. But at the same time, he was a very public figure and a very public anti-communist crusader and founded the Arena political party, which went on to be one of the most important political parties in El Salvador. In fact, was in charge of the government for a number of years. So Davison is a central figure and had, you know, a key role in ordering the assassination of Archbishop Romero. He actually died in 1992. So he was not an active suspect in our case because he had passed away many years before, but he is a central figure. And the judge in our case eventually concluded that he was the mastermind of the assassination. The other person you mentioned, the dentist, Hector Regalado, is also an important figure in the death squads in El Salvador, but he is somebody who was suspected for many years of being the shooter. And in fact, I don't think that is true. And the Truth Commission concluded that he likely was not. But he was very closely tied to Roberto Davison and had been his chief of security in the Salvadoran legislature. And so there were, political reasons for trying to tie him to the assassination. The driver had identified a photo of him as someone likely to have been the shooter, but the photo was likely very old and had been tampered with. And so it's not clear that was, you know, an accurate identification anyway. So he's an important figure in the death squads in El Salvador, but not necessarily in Romero's assassination. There were other people who had been named, particularly by the Truth Commission, But you're right that they did not have connections that we knew of to the United States and so weren't named as defendants. But what we did try to do, the case that we initially filed was against Sarabia himself. And then we put in what were known as DOES 1 through 10. And those DOES were the people above Sarabia that we hoped to be able to bring into the case as defendants because, you know, we did have evidence that wealthier figures who might have been financing the death squad operations did have homes in Miami. And there was evidence of death squad planning from Miami. And so that was something that we hoped to eventually include in the case were the names of some of those people.
The defense, what was the defense?
So interestingly, there never actually was a defense. This was a civil lawsuit. It was not a criminal case because there were no laws in the United States that would have permitted a criminal prosecution against Saravia for a murder that happened in El Salvador. And the tool that was used at that time, in particular in the United States, was a law called the Alien Tort Statute, and then another later law called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And it allowed for civil lawsuits to seek basically money compensation against individuals who are involved in human rights abuses. And so the case that we were able to bring was a civil lawsuit against Saravia. And although that's perhaps not a satisfying result in that nobody was going to go to jail, in fact, it ended up being helpful because Saravia disappeared. We never actually saw him in person, but because it was a civil lawsuit, we were allowed to proceed based on the fact that we had significant evidence tying him to a specific address in Modesto, California. And the court eventually found that that evidence was enough to allow the case to proceed in spite of the fact that we had not actually seen Saravia. And he ended up not entering a defense in the case and not appearing in the case, but we were nonetheless able to proceed to trial against him. But one of the central stories running through the book is our search for him, because we actually did want to find him, not only because, you know, we thought that the case would have more impact if he was actually spotted and identified, but indeed that we knew that he had a lot of information about the death squad and powerful figures who financed the death squad. And we hoped that perhaps he would be willing to give us information, you know, about those people, perhaps in exchange for considering settling the lawsuit.
Well, Matt Eisenbrandt, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for your time and for this really great book. It's called Assassination of a Saint.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Matt Eisenbrandt is the legal director of the Canadian Center for International Justice and the author of Assassination of a Saint, The Plot to Murder Oscar Romero and the Quest to Bring His Killers to Justice. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.